From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The vulgar spectacle of Donald Trump's presidential run has yielded at least two benefits. The first is the refreshing sight of a candidate so rich he needn't prostrate himself before the checkbooks and agendas of Sheldon Adelson and the Koch brothers. The second benefit has accrued specifically to one institution, Fox News Channel.
It is 9 p.m. on the East Coast, and the moment of truth has arrived.
With 24 million viewers, last week's Republican primary debate was the most watched program in Fox history. Not only does Trump have a sort of demolition derby appeal, you know there'll be wreckage, his brand of bellicose bigotry happens to overlap with Fox's overwhelmingly aging, angry white audience. But Trump is a double-edged swordsman. Just one night after the debate, during which Fox's moderators peppered him with tough questions, Trump called in to CNN Tonight and complained to host Don Lemon.
I'm here in front of all these people. I'm doing Fox a favor by doing this show. And then they, you know, come out with these vicious questions.
I'm disappointed in Fox News. I think they probably had an agenda, but certainly I don't have a lot of respect for Megyn Kelly.
You know, you could see there was blood coming out of her eyes, blood coming out of her wherever.
By leaning in on Trump, debate moderator Kelly turned Trump's blade against Fox. And according to New York Magazine National Affairs editor Gabriel Sherman, Fox News chief Roger Ailes faced a grave choice.
They were desperately trying to sort of make a political calculation of whether they staunchly back their star anchor or appeal to the angry audience that Trump seems to be, you know, building a political coalition out of that just happens to dovetail with Fox viewers. And we saw in the end, the value of the audience exceeded the value of protecting and defending Megyn Kelly.
They did try to head off the possibility of some sort of anti-Fox sentiment in the arena with the first question that Bret Baier asked all of the candidates.
Is there anyone on stage, and can I see hands, who is unwilling tonight to pledge your support to the eventual nominee of the Republican Party and pledge to not run an independent campaign against that person? Again, we're looking for you to raise your hand now if you won't make that pledge tonight. Mr. Trump.
The moment Trump's hand shot up, the entire audience started booing him. And these are, you know, Republican faithful, the people who turn out to watch primary debates live. And this was treason to them. The arena was electric, but the strategy backfired because inside the Trump campaign, that first question was viewed as a political hit, calculated to turn the party against him. And that is what fueled his anti-Fox News crusade over the past week. It wasn't just Kelly's comments about women. It was that first question as well. And so Roger Ailes may have scored kind of a tactical victory in the debate by getting the moderators to ask that question. But the strategic failure was that it turned Trump against Fox.
So what did Ailes have to do to appease the Donald and the extremists in his own audience?
Well, if it was a process that took days. I mean, Ailes was reluctant to get on the phone with Trump. There was a fear that Trump was so unpredictable that he might leak the conversation or somehow damage Fox News by publicizing it in some way.
And it wasn't a baseless concern because Trump had revealed the private cell phone number of Lindsey Graham at a campaign event.
Yes. So it was left to others. Sean Hannity had a conversation with Donald Trump over that weekend in which Trump declared that he was going to boycott Fox. And on Monday, Ailes decided to finally pick up the phone and call Trump. And he offered Trump a one-hour special with Megyn Kelly to clear the air. But Trump threw that offer out the window. And so Ailes frantically offered Fox and Friends, a venue that has been especially friendly to Trump's campaign, and Hannity as well. Trump, in the end, agreed after exacting concessions from Ailes, in which he guaranteed him that Fox would cover him, quote, fairly. Now, the best part of this exchange is that Roger Ailes then called Trump several other times that morning and asked him to tweet out to his millions of followers that all was okay between his campaign and the network. That shows you the desperation Ailes felt to smooth things over with Trump's audience.
This raises the question of what constituted the supposed unfairness. What Megyn Kelly did was ask Trump to account for his nakedly misogynist statements.
You've called women you don't like fat pigs, dogs, slobs, and disgusting animals. You once told a contestant on Celebrity Apprentice it would be a pretty picture to see her on her knees. Does that sound to you like the temperament of a man we should elect as president? And how will you answer the charge from Hillary Clinton, who is likely to be the Democratic nominee, that you are part of the war on women?
Honestly, Megan, if you don't like it, I'm sorry. I've been very nice to you, although I could probably maybe not be based on the way you have treated me, but I wouldn't do that.
It's a perfectly reasonable journalistic path to explore, but...
But, you know, fairness is in the eye of the beholder. And as anyone who watches Fox News knows, the network is built on being the voice of a segment of the population that feels the culture is out to get them. And the fact that Megyn Kelly seemed to be siding with that other side of the culture was too much for the audience to bear.
What if Donald Trump does make good his threat to run as a third party? Fox News has become the institution it is by being the de facto house organ of the right wing and the Republican Party. Does this mean he will throw the Republicans under the bus in order to focus on a Trump third-party run for the president?
Well, I think that would be the biggest test that Roger Ailes will face as a chairman and CEO of the network. It would force him to choose between his angry, loyal audience and a broader Republican electorate that will be turned off by a Trump candidacy. Now, my gut tells me that there is no way he would abandon the Republican Party to back a Trump third party run. Roger Ailes is a creature of the Republican Party. He's been involved in Republican politics since 1968. But I think it's going to be a test because his audience is much further to the right than Jeb Bush or any of the other candidates that eventually will win the nomination.
And you just said we'll win the nomination. My questions assumed precisely the same thing. But maybe we're missing something that Roger Ailes may himself know. As someone who has written a book about Ailes and who has, like everyone else, been in full Trump immersion for the last number of weeks, do you think the outcome here could be unexpected?
I've been loath to make any predictions when it comes to Donald Trump. I think that's what makes him both so powerful and so unpredictable. I sort of make this comparison to Sarah Palin. You know, Sarah Palin was the kind of right-wing phenomenon. And yet Sarah Palin's star faded because at the end of the day, she was dependent upon larger, more powerful interests to keep her relevant. Donald Trump is not dependent on anyone. He can get on his jet, fly around the country, give speeches. If we learned anything this last week, Fox News is more dependent on Donald Trump at this point than Donald Trump needs Fox News.
Gabriel, thanks so much.
Good to be with you.
Gabriel Sherman is National Affairs Editor at New York Magazine and also the author of The Loudest Voice in the Room, How the Brilliant, Bombastic Roger Ailes Built Fox News and Divided a Country.
You know, talking about a lot of leverage, we want to win and we will win.
Meanwhile, on the left, Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Lessig wants to be president. Sort of. We spoke with him last summer about his effort to neutralize super PACs with his own that backed congressional candidates who support campaign finance reform. That effort, the May Day super PAC, didn't go so well. But now Lessig has a new strategy for leveling the political playing field. If he can crowdfund $1 million by Labor Day, he'll run for president on a platform of election reform. And if he wins, as if, he'll serve only until Congress legislates fairness into our democratic process with passage of the Citizen Equality Act of 2017. Then he'll resign, leaving his vice president, maybe Bernie Sanders, maybe Elizabeth Warren, in the White House. As of Thursday evening, when we're recording this, Lessig has raised nearly 20% of his goal from donors. Lawrence Lessig, welcome back to On the Media.
It's great to be back.
So this is a media show. And campaign finance is very much a media issue because most of the money is spent on TV ads. But we're also a media show, and we understand media manipulation. By having you here, we have been sucked into the vortex of your publicity strategy. You are not going to be president of the United States. What is this all about?
As Elizabeth Warren puts it, the system is rigged. And so what I'm trying to do is to run a campaign to focus attention on the thing we all already recognize, that we have to fix the rigged system if we're to have any hope of having a democracy that represents us again.
Lay out, please, the provisions of the Citizens Equality Act of 2017.
Number one, we would have equal freedom to vote. Strategies that are used to suppress the vote would be no longer permitted. Number two, we would have equal representation. Changing the way districts are drawn and rules for electing members of Congress so that we would have the chance for as many people as possible to be effectively represented in Congress. And number three, the part that's most important to me, is to change the way we fund elections so we don't have this perverse system for electing candidates to Congress. You know, in the South, they used to have the white primary. Only whites were allowed to vote in the Democratic primary. We don't have a white primary anymore. We have a green primary. And it trades on a fundamental insight of one of the most important political philosophers in the history of political philosophy, Boss Tweed, head of Tammany Hall, who used to say, I don't care who does the electing as long as I get to do the nominating. Because what Tweed knew is that if he got to nominate the candidates, they would always worry what he thought. And that's the system we've produced with money.
Let's just pretend that you actually had a chance of pulling this off. Let's just pretend. Once you do get elected on your one-issue platform, you do what?
Well, I'm going to fight the assumption we're pretending. Obviously, I get incredible implausibility of what I'm talking about happening. But what I've described is a series of steps. If the first step establishes a large number of people supporting the idea, I can run and get the kind of attention that makes it plausible that I could be in the debates. Practically every single question that will be asked on that debate stage is tied fundamentally to the corrupted inequality of this political system. I don't think it's crazy to imagine that Democrats react as viscerally and passionately to this point as Republicans are reacting when Donald Trump makes the same point.
I give to everybody. When they call, I give. And you know what? When I need something from them 2 years later, 3 years later, I call them. They are there for me.
So what
and that's
get?
A broken system. So
he got the attention of a predominantly right-wing audience.
One could, you know, be a little bit surprised that it takes Donald Trump to say it for us to believe it. But okay, I'll take belief however we can get it. Now, this is not just rhetoric, right? We have extraordinary amounts of actual empirical political science to back this up, like a really incredible study. It's a Princeton study, so as a Harvard professor, I'm not supposed to mention it, but here it is. What they found was, over a 30-year period, while the views of the economic elite were strongly related to what our government actually did. For the average voter, the relationship was literally, on the graph, a flat line. What that means is there is no statistical correlation between what the average voters want and what our government does, independent of what the rich might happen to want or what organized interest groups might happen to want. And we have got to finally find a way to take it on and do something about it.
This is not your first quixotic tilt at political equity. In the introduction, we referred to your May Day super PAC, which you formed last spring in order to help elect legislators who would serve the interests of the people as opposed to big money. Your super PAC invested in 8 races. You lost 6 of them, and 2 were regarded as easy wins. Why do you think that the Lessig for President campaign is going to be more availing?
Now, it's not true to say that the 2 races were simple races. One, we were confident of, but the other was a very important victory in a Democratic primary for a candidate who took this issue up. I'm doing 2 things that respond precisely to what we saw from the May Day experiment last year. Number one, we are fighting this in the primary, where nobody's worried about whether their side's going to ultimately win. They're just deciding what are the values of their party. And I think the values of the Democratic Party should embrace the idea of equal citizenship. Number two, one important lesson we learned in the May Day Project was that people are extremely skeptical that there's anything that can be done.
In June, a Wall Street Journal NBC poll found that one-third of Americans say the top concern in the presidential election is the influence of big money. On the other hand, the electorate is not frothing at the mouth over campaign finance reform unless asked by pollsters.
Indeed, there was a poll done by the Claris Group that found that 80% of Americans think every reform ever passed was a reform to benefit the incumbents. We are so cynical, so skeptical of efforts to reform the system that we don't even listen to it anymore. That's the politics of resignation. And that's exactly what I think we see observed in campaigns that try to raise this issue. Now, if we had a referendum on this question, we'd win easily. The problem is we don't have a referendum at the federal level. So what I'm saying is here's a strategy like a referendum that if we could convince people that, you know, this is plausible, they might begin to thaw their resignation and say, okay, let's give this a try because this, in fact, could give me what I want, a government that is no longer corrupted.
One final question. Do you have a slogan?
Sure. Equal citizens first.
No, no, no. Listen, my friend, you're a law professor. I've got a very, very rich history in advertising. That's not your slogan. Ready?
Please, give me my slogan. Do I have to pay for this?
Well, you have to deal with the Mies van der Rohe estate.
Okay.
The slogan is, Lessig's more.
I've seen that slogan.
Larry, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Lawrence Lessig is a Harvard law professor, but maybe not for long. He is hoping to raise $1 million by Labor Day as a sign that he should run for president.
Coming up, a new Pentagon manual sees journalists as potential belligerents.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, a year after Michael Brown was shot by white police officer Darren Wilson, Ferguson, Missouri was thrust back into the national spotlight, filtered through a lens of deja vu.
The state of emergency now in effect on the streets of Ferguson, Missouri. In fact, all of
we know that some very high-profile people have been arrested in the name of justice, they say, including Dr. Cornel West.
The jury are looking into another police shooting not far from where Michael Brown was gunned down 1 year ago.
They say they shot Tyrone Harris, leaving him in critical condition, after they say the suspect shot at them following a chase.
In Ferguson, coverage comes in waves. Michael Brown's death last August, the grand jury verdict in November, the Justice Department's scathing report on the Ferguson Police Department in March, and now. With each spike of media attention, a reminder for residents of Ferguson and St. Louis that attention is not only transient, but often misguided. St. Louis-based reporter Sarah Kenzior wrote a piece this week for Politico called Ferguson's Never-Ending Nightmare. She says the media's metrics for covering her town are far too narrow.
They wonder, is this a story worth investing in? Should we bother to send our reporters here? If there's not violence on the street or an aggressive police reaction, is it worth covering? And that's what's frustrating. I think the issues that affect people on a day-to-day basis in Ferguson and in the rest of St. Louis are worth covering. But those are issues like poverty, lack of opportunity, hotspot policing, aggressive policing. All of those have happened every single day that the media has not been in town. And I don't think they get the sort of interrogation by the news media that they should. Instead, there's a preference for dramatic acts of violence.
Duh. The arrests of many high-profile protesters like the public intellectual and activist Cornel West garner the most media attention. But how does that influence how the situation is perceived, both locally and nationally?
I think when you arrest people like Cornel West, who are not from here, obviously, and who have a high national profile, the police like to put forth this narrative of outsiders coming in to cause trouble. In Baltimore, you saw the exact same kind of rhetoric. This gives credence to that rhetoric. And I think that that's why they went after the kind of high profile people that they did.
You call this a brutally effective tactic.
Well, I think on a lot of people in St. Louis, this works. I think it causes them to see the protest movement as something distant from them and, you know, something that maybe should be clamped down upon because they're not recognizing the people in this story. people underestimate how exhausted St. Louis as a whole is. You know, we've had a year of violence, of two states of emergency now. There's a segment of St. Louis residents that don't want anything to do with the protest movement. They call for things to get, quote, back to normal, neglecting that normal for the poor Black part of St. Louis means poverty, police repression, lack of opportunity, means a lot of issues that should be addressed. But when the police crack down like this, it exhausts people and they want to look away, and this helps them look away.
What stories do you think are just consistently missing?
When I went to a community meeting about policing in December, people took to the podium to share their concerns. And, you know, a lot of them claimed they've been suffering from PTSD since August, from being tear gassed or just from the constant stress of things like states of emergency, of buildings being boarded, of the national spotlight being on the worst elements of the city. There are a lot of young people, especially in St. Louis, who are angry, who are frustrated, you know, who have a chronic lack of opportunity. And that contributes to the homicide spike that's increased 60% over the last year. We have robbery increased, I think, 39% over the last year. And so this is just a very dark and stressful time for St. Louis.
You wrote, "We are a showcase of shame with no end in sight."
Yes, and it's a terrible thing to be, you know, looked at and grieved for only as a symbol instead of as a person. I'm not convinced that people really care what happens to people in St. Louis or there would be sustained media attention on these issues. That's something that's also true for cities like Baltimore or Cleveland, where you see similar events in a similar economic structure.
Well, let's talk about Watts in L.A. This week is the 50th anniversary of the Watts riots. The parallels between that and what's been happening in Ferguson are so chilling.
Yes, and you know, I would add to that the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. It's like this triad of despair for Black communities across the United States, where you look for signs of change and progress and you see how little has been accomplished. I think Watts is a warning of what happens when you don't turn things around.
But here's the thing. Doug Smith, who's a longtime reporter for the LA Times, wrote a piece this week about how the LA Times covered the riots in 65 and how the coverage evolved over 11 days of reporting. He wrote that in the early days, he was struck by how the paper gave unchallenged space to the invective of city officials and adopted the us versus them tone with, quote, the Negro. Gradually, the coverage began to reflect more deeply on the social forces at work there. And he wrote, "The riots made the LA Times a better newspaper. Has the last year made us better journalists at all?"
I don't necessarily think that it's improved the quality of mainstream journalism. You know, the difference between now and the time when the Watts riots took place is that there's social media and people who are present on the ground have the ability to convey their own narrative of what's going on. You know, we now are on our fourth go-round in Ferguson, and while journalists maybe have a better sense of the geography and of the dynamics of the city, they're not necessarily doing a better job. But it's good, I think, that people have another source to go to.
You're one of the few locally based reporters writing for a national audience. You hit pretty much the same theme, which is pay attention to the people here, pay attention to the underlying conditions. Do you feel like you're making a dent?
I don't know. I mean, I don't feel like I'm necessarily making a dent where it counts, which is, you know, in St. Louis. I think that I've helped create greater awareness. You know, to my knowledge, I was the first national reporter to tweet about the story before it hit even the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. And so I've tried to just at least keep the story out there. You know, this part of the country is dismissed often as flyover country, and the people who live here are dismissed in turn. But when I write something, I get emails from all over the country saying, you know, this reminds me of my city. This reminds me of the conditions that I'm living in, too. And they're glad to see it covered.
Sarah, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Sarah Kendzior is a writer based in St. Louis. Her recent piece for Politico is called Ferguson's Never-Ending Nightmare.
This This summer, the Department of Defense released its long-awaited Law of War Manual, a nearly 1,200-page document and the first ever department-wide codification of the Pentagon's wartime protocols. Many of these guidelines are uncontroversial. Prisoners of war should be given sufficient drinking water, for instance. But buried within are wholly unexpected standards for treating journalists. Standards, as a New York Times editorial pointed out, reminiscent of the most authoritarian regimes. Among them, the notion that journalists may in some cases be classified as unprivileged belligerents and treated as spies. Charles A. Allen is the Deputy General Counsel for International Affairs at the Department of Defense. It was his office that released the manual this June. Chuck, welcome to On the Media.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Let's start with this. Unprivileged belligerents? It sounds an awful lot like unlawful combatants, which is what Guantanamo is filled with. What constitutes an unprivileged belligerent?
Well, the term unprivileged belligerent is pretty much the same as unlawful enemy combatant. In the case of the ongoing conflict against Al-Qaeda, for example, member of the enemy forces. By no means is the manual equating journalists or NGO personnel or any other civilian with unprivileged belligerency. The reference to unprivileged belligerence is only to point out that one can abandon his or her position as a civilian and become a member of the enemy forces.
And if in the heat of battle, a commander finds a journalist who he deems to have surrendered his privileges by whatever actions, is he subject to arrest? Does he lose due process? What happens to an unprivileged belligerent?
Well, actually, your question points out a big part of the value of this manual. We have wonderful military personnel serving our country overseas, and they want to do the job right. So this is, I think, a resource that helps them to be able to give the best advice to command. But the idea suggested in your hypothetical of targeting that person, perhaps detaining that person as an unprivileged belligerent, there would be a lot of analysis and a lot of legwork and a lot of legal process and potentially research that goes into any such decision.
I just want to call attention to one passage within the manual, which states that, quote, relaying of information, such as providing information of immediate use in combat operations, could constitute taking direct part in hostilities and thereby disqualifying a journalist of civilian protections. Apart from the fact that revealing operational details is a violation of our own ethics, have you any cases where an operation was jeopardized by reporters in the field in any of the last, I don't know, five wars? Does this even happen?
I don't have specific cases in mind. I think that the fact that we don't have a lot of examples could be a tribute to the press corps and my colleagues in the public affairs area. There's a salutary purpose in some of the provisions in this section, and that is to underscore the importance of distinguishing oneself as a journalist in order to avoid being mistaken as a member of the enemy forces. So we're trying to be more comprehensive than previous manuals, but we have gone into this area that seems to have raised some questions. And of course, we're very interested in hearing about people's responses to not only this, but to the whole manual.
Well, you're fixing to hear one, because your manual is concerned with bad journalistic apples of whom you can offer no examples. I, on the other hand, can offer many examples of military misfeasance and malfeasance and cover-ups and even atrocities. My concern is that in the hands of such a bad apple commander, the manual could be used as a document of impunity for commanders who are just trying to operate badly under the radar to save themselves from embarrassment, prosecution, or worse.
I don't disagree with you, but I also point out that's one of the main reasons for having this manual out there. Lawyers who are practicing in the military have ethical requirements. Their client is the U.S. government. It is not their individual commander. And you have to disseminate the information and the nuances of the law in order for legal advisors and the commanders that they're advising so that they can adhere to them.
Chuck, one need only follow recent episodes in North Korea and China, and especially Iran, to be concerned with this language from the manual, quote, "To avoid being mistaken for spies, journalists should act openly and with the permission of relevant authorities." That's kind of jaw-dropping to me. Does the Pentagon not understand that journalists aren't in the employ of or subject to the orders of the military?
You know, there are ground rules agreed to by the media, which involve the limiting or embargoing of the release of some militarily sensitive information because lives are at stake. I am concerned that people are reading that provision the way that you have described it. There was no intention to change any of the ongoing rules and arrangements that apply to our strong policy of cooperation with the media.
Does the Pentagon intend to revisit the law of war manual to make sure that none of these ambiguities become the law of the military?
We are certainly going to consider the comments that have been made and others that we expect to be made. Again, this is manual has been out really only a matter of weeks. And we would consider those with regard to this section, which has, again, about two pages of a very large manual. That's not to say it's a small matter. The fact that it is being construed in the way it has been is something of major concern to us. We are going to be receiving comments, and those will be considered seriously as we make updates to the manual.
When shall I check back with you?
I'd be happy to be in contact with you on a frequent basis. If you'd like to know where we are, where we're going on this particular issue, I'd say perhaps in a couple of weeks we could get back with you.
That would be fantastic. Chuck, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Bob. I really appreciate the time and the discussion we've had.
Charles A. Allen is the Deputy General Counsel for International Affairs at the Department of Defense.
Coming up, a movie about a journalist hanging out with a novelist? Surely you jest.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, the film The End of the Tour came out in wide release. It follows Rolling Stone writer David Lipsky as he travels with David Foster Wallace during the last leg of the 1996 book tour for his masterwork, Infinite Jest. Over many hours in flight and smoke-filled cars around the frozen Midwest, Lipsky recorded their wide-ranging conversations. They discuss everything from the role of fiction in modern society to the seductions of sudden celebrity to, well, Baywatch.
I don't think writers are any smarter than other people. I think they're maybe more compelling in their stupidity or in their confusion.
But when Lipsky returned, Rolling Stone quickly redirected him to a breaking story, so his tapes gathered dust for 12 years until David Foster Wallace committed suicide in 2008. Rolling Stone then pressed for the piece, which Lipsky wrote, and it won a National Magazine Award, and then he followed up with a book called Although, of Course, You End Up Becoming Yourself, composed largely of the tape transcripts. The End of the Tour is based on that book. Jason Segel plays Wallace and Jesse Eisenberg, Lipsky.
You're like a nervous guy, huh?
No, I'm okay. How are you?
I'm terrified.
Are you?
Yes, you're not alone in this.
Okay.
We'll do this together.
No, I think it's going to be a lot of fun.
David Lipsky, welcome to On the Media.
It's great to be here, Brooke. Thank you.
So, let's go back to 1996. Wallace's 1,000-page Infinite Jest has just made him an instant literary rock star. New York Magazine's Walter Kern says that it's locked up the National Book Awards. Now, Rolling Stone hadn't done a profile of an author in 10 years. The movie shows you pushing for the assignment.
But in real life, Jan Wenner saw a review in the New York Times, and he saw that David Wallace had a bandana and had long hair, and he said, he's one of us, send Lipsky.
You arrive, and one of the major themes of your talks together is trust. He seems painfully concerned about how he's coming across and how you will ultimately depict him. And we have a clip of it from the movie.
I'm sorry, man.
What's wrong?
It's just you're going to go back to New York and, like, sit at your desk and shape this thing however you want. That, I mean, to me, it's just extremely disturbing.
Why is it disturbing?
Because I think I would like to shape the impression of me that's coming across. Yeah.
I
don't even know if I like you yet. So nervous about whether you like me.
When I hear it in my ears, which is the way that I listen to the tapes, it always sounds like him.
Jason Segel.
Yeah. When I came across that sentence in the transcript after his death, where he was saying that he wanted to be in control of how he was coming across, that was how I decided to do the book. And it's kind of the way they decided to do the movie, too, which is just let him tell his own story.
And yet, in a book, you have to read it. Wallace says that a quote is different when it's transmuted onto the page.
Stuff said out loud on the page doesn't look said out loud. It's just a crazy.
Stuff said out loud on the page doesn't look said out loud. It just looks crazy.
He's one of the only writers that I've ever talked to who, when he talks, talks in his prose.
So
he was wrong. I mean, he's extremely smart, but he was wrong about that. It was a great thing. Rather than having to say, here's what I thought he was thinking during high school, just to have him tell his story.
I'm wondering, now that you're watching yourself adapted and depicted on film, how does that feel? Jason Segel and Jesse Eisenberg, tense, wary, depicting you and Wallace in a ring, dancing around each other, not necessarily trying to land punches, but trying to avoid them.
Jesse and Jason in the movie, they're both young men, and they're trying to decide what they want their lives to be about, and they have different perspectives on that. I think that you have two people who are writers, and they are trying to get a sense of who the other person is. And so there are a lot of feints and ideas you'll throw out to see which one the other person will respond to. So what you're seeing there is reporter tennis.
There's another anxiety of his that fills the transcripts, how his sudden success threatens his fragile equilibrium.
I wouldn't be so careful about this kind of stuff if I felt very much confidence that I could handle it well. And I'm aware that this makes very good copy and this will be a neat part of the article, but it's also really like, you know, I feel like we sort of become friends and understand that. I mean, this stuff, it's great, but it's also really scary at the same time because I've got what I hope is like 40 more years of work ahead of me.
Pretty heartbreaking, that last line. But when Wallace says, we've sort of become friends, did you think that was a manipulation?
No, I mean, when you've talked about Die Hard with somebody and its sequels, I think you've become friends. And I also think that if you're driving with someone, it's just something that happens. After mile 41, up to mile 40, you can be strangers or you can be considerate or seatmates, but at mile 41, you become friends.
But there's that scene in the movie where Lipsky, your character, goes into Wallace's bathroom, makes notes of what's in the medicine cabinet, and later your Rolling Stone editor asks you to press him on his rumored heroin addiction, and you say, well, here's a clip.
What am I supposed to say? Is it true you were a heroin addict?
Yes, that's your story.
Oh, okay, well, it's hard.
Why? Because you like him?
Well, yeah, yes.
David, you gotta press him.
Okay.
Be a prick if you have to. You're not his best buddy.
I know.
You're a reporter.
All right.
How did you thread that needle? At one point, he gets incredibly testy, almost scary. He's a big guy.
He's a big guy. In the book, I write that he looks like someone who might invite you to play hacky sack, and then if you didn't, he might consider persuading you. but for him to get the attention in Rolling Stone, part of the deal was getting these questions that might be unpleasant, and for me, getting the chance to travel with him for 5 days, the bargain on my side was asking questions that were not fun to ask.
Tell me about that weird conflict over his ex-girlfriend. Now, that's not in the book. I know that as Donald Margulies, the script writer, was reading your book, he noticed an enormous change in the tone. It got quite frosty, but he couldn't find a reason for it.
Donald's a very smart writer, so he said, when you're coming back from Minneapolis, the tone is very different. Did something happen there? We had been traveling at that point for 3 days. I think we'd both kind of forgotten what I was doing there. So when I go to talk to a former girlfriend of his, trying to get secondary sources, you know, he just saw a tall person talking to his ex-girlfriend and said, hey, don't do that.
I saw you hitting on Betsy. You got her to give you her address?
No. I got her to give me her email address in case I had questions about the piece that I am writing about
really?
You.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, really.
Well, I'll tell you what.
What?
I don't want her talking to you.
I won't contact
her. Look, I told you that Betsy and I dated during grad school. The least, look at me, the least you could, no, you're not. The least you could do is show me the respect of not coming on to her right in front of me.
I remember that Jason was talking about the times they shot that. And he said that the first time when he stood up very tall, and Jason's a big man, that when he made that speech, Jesse started crying. So that he had to redo it and do it in the softer way that's in the movie.
Now, prior to that, Wallace spoke to your girlfriend on the phone. You called her. She'd been reading Infinite Jest. He says, let me talk to her. They talk for 30 minutes. You're watching. It's kind of excruciating.
She loved his work. And so it's great to be able to call and say, hey, here he is on the phone. And then there's that other thing, which is when someone you really care about is having more fun talking to someone else. But then there's the mixed thing, because it's like, yes, this guy's great, as I told you, but don't think he's that great. Actually, I suppose it must have been like his watching me talk to Betsy.
You and Wallace have amazing conversations about pop culture. Alanis Morissette, Steven Spielberg, Green Day, R.E.M., Hanson. There's a moment when Wallace discusses the seductions of entertainment.
We were making jokes about Love Boat and Baywatch with these really, the really commercial, really reductive shows that we so love to sneer at are also tremendously compelling, because the predictability in popular art, the really formulaic stuff, is so profoundly soothing. And it gives you a sense of order, that everything's going to be all right. That this is a narrative that will take care of you and won't in any way challenge you. It's like being wrapped in a chamois blanket and nestled against a big, generous tit.
He goes on to say that despite the comforts of popular culture, serious art eventually will out. It's an optimistic thought. He seemed to swing precipitously between two poles.
I think what he was saying was how I think a lot of people, listeners to this show, will listen to NPR. And then when they're in their car, they also will be listening to some great music that puts them in a good mood. And that takes care of them. And
because NPR certainly won't.
No, it will, but NPR will require something of you. It will require that you engage. It will require that you think about your opinion. It will require you to change your opinion. Whereas the other stuff, it allows you to relax. And what he was saying is that you have to do both.
But he tells you that he's a TV addict. In fact, he says it's his only addiction. And then he takes the idea to its logical conclusion. And we have a clip of it from the movie.
Look, as the internet grows in the next 10, 15 years, and virtual reality pornography becomes a reality, mm-hmm. we're going to have to develop some real machinery inside our guts to turn off pure unalloyed pleasure, or I don't know about you, I'm going to have to leave the planet.
Why?
Because the technology is just going to get better and better, and it's going to get easier and easier and more convenient and more pleasurable to sit alone with images on a screen given to us by people who do not love us but want our money. And that's fine in low doses. But if it's the basic main staple of your diet, you're going to die.
At the same time that he was saying that TV can take care of you, he also doesn't have a TV in his house because he doesn't want to be taken care of all the time. What he said was that the basic message you keep getting from TV is that you're stupid and that there are parts of us that are a lot more ambitious than that. His idea of a challenging book like Infinite Jest is that it would nourish that part of you too.
Have you any idea how many people who bought Infinite Jest actually finished it?
I think there's an idea that it's difficult to read. But it's as difficult as reading 5 200-page books back to back.
Yeah, but that's how long all the collected works of Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is, but it doesn't scare me.
Well, Brooke, what does scare you about Infinite Jest?
I guess because I've spoken to so many people who said they couldn't get through it.
I think with David's work, one of the things, when you look at his syllabuses, you know, he would teach Stephen King and Mary Higgins Clark. His diet wasn't only the serious stuff. It was also the book equivalent of shows like Baywatch and The Old Love Boat. And so the book is written by somebody who knows how to construct a really cool, involving story. So I think it's just the length. Books like David Wallace's wake you up, and that's the reason to read them, because you walk in asleep, and then when you walk out, the world is in color.
You two really seem to get each other, and that seemed to create a space for some real candor. Like, at one point in the tapes, he says, I've decided that I really need to find a few things that I believe in order to stay alive.
Which means that I have to structure my life, you know, sort of like anybody who's dedicated to something, to maximize my ability to do good stuff. And it doesn't make me a great person. It just makes me a person that's really exhausted a couple other ways to live, you know, and really taken them to their conclusion, which for me was a pink room, you know, with no furniture and a drain in the center floor, which is where they put me for an entire day when they thought I was going to kill myself, where they, you don't have anything on and somebody's observing you through a slot in the wall. And when that happens to you, you get tremendous, you get unprecedentedly willing to examine other alternatives for how to live.
One thing that's playing through every viewer's mind when they see the end of the tour, and every reader's mind as they read your book, is that he's going to kill himself. How does that not inform every thought we have about David Foster Wallace? And how do you combat that?
He is the most alive writer of the last two or three decades. And when you're reading him, it sounds the way we flatter ourselves that our brains sound to us. He said a great thing about writing. He said that he didn't think that writers were smarter than other people, but what they were able to do was sit and clench their fists and think very hard about the stuff that we only think about occasionally in our daily lives. When the writer does her job right, she wakes the reader up to stuff the reader was aware of all along. That is what he was like as a writer. When someone is a suicide, we often will begin to read their work entirely through that gray lens. And when I sat down to think about this book, what I wanted to show is, hey, he is not just a very alive writer. He is the most alive person that I've spent time with. And that's who he was. He's not just someone who, when he was 46, ended his own life.
Thank you very much.
It's been great to be on, Brooke. I wanted to hear more clips.
We have one more. Let's play it.
I'm not so sure you want to be me.
I don't.
Give my best to Jan.
That's great.
Did he say that?
No, he didn't say that. Mm-hmm. What he said before we left was that ambitions for ourselves can be great, they can be motivating, they can be a flamethrower held to our ass, but past a certain point, they can be toxic. You know, what he was saying was that that actually is what happens when you get what you want.
Did any of that stuff stick with you?
We never saw each other again. And part of it was that he was a much more successful writer than I was. And I was always afraid that if I went and emailed him or tried to call him or talk to him, that that would always be there. And one of the things he had said was that it'd be interesting to talk to me again in a few years when I had had some of the experiences he had had. And so I had always waited. And then when that time came, you know, I would write emails saying, I would like to have that conversation now. And there's a thing that I do when I'm unsure about an email is I take the actual address off and I email it to myself to see how it looks. And I would get these emails and I would think, that looks like a crazy person wrote it. So I never sent them.
David, thank you very much.
It's been great being here, Brooke. Thanks for having me.
David Lipsky is a contributing editor to Rolling Stone and the author of Although, of course, you end up becoming yourself, among many other books, including The Art Fair.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Kimmy Regler, Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, and Sam Dingman. We had more help from Maya Brownstein, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.